Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
If we wanted to do that, we had to go find a natural and organic retail store because there was very little to none available in the conventional space. Today, if we want to begin to make different choices in the groceries we buy, we don't have to leave Kroger. It's already there.
C.E. Pugh of the National Co-op Grocers. He talks about the state of co-op groceries in the U.S. and how increased competition from conventional stores is offering a unique set of challenges. From Harvest Public Media, we visit a food pantry that offers food assistance and gardening classes. A couple recipes for us as well. Chef Daniel Orr plucks some squash flowers from his garden. And then Jackie Howard of Bee's Soda Bar makes her own root beer, and you can too. We'll get the latest update on the avian flu outbreak in the Midwest. But first, Luann Johnson has this story.
Just as the summer harvest season kicks into gear, a computer error at the U.S. State Department has left thousands of temporary agricultural workers stranded, costing farmers up to $1 million a day in California alone. Since June 9th, problems in the system that transmits fingerprints and other biometric security data from consulates have brought H-2A agricultural visa applications to a standstill. More than 1,000 farm workers are waiting for approval, according to the Wall Street Journal. Farmers from California, Washington State, and across the Midwest have reported crops are rotting in the fields due to the labor shortfall. Farm groups reported that hundreds of workers are waiting in Tijuana across the border from Mexico and Monterrey near Texas. Lost days of work can be devastating for seasonal farmhands, who often give up work in rural areas and travel long distances by bus to reach the border. The U.S. issued 9.9 million visas to tourists and temporary workers last year. The Food and Drug Administration ruled Tuesday that partially hydrogenated oils are no longer generally recognized as safe for use in food and must be phased out within 3 years. Partially hydrogenated oils are commonly known as trans fats, and they've been used to extend shelf life and enhance flavor of foods. Many food manufacturers and restaurants have already stopped using trans fats. As a result, estimated trans fat consumption has declined 78% since 2003. The Grocery Manufacturers Association is working on a formal petition to the FDA to request exceptions to the zero trans fat rule. And agriculture officials don't know just how the massive outbreak of avian flu in the Midwest was spread, but believe the culprits include humans breaking biosecurity measures and the virus going airborne. Up to this point, officials had blamed the introduction and spread of this virulent, highly pathogenic H5N2 virus on migratory birds. A preliminary study released Monday said researchers had found no specific pathway that led to the largest outbreak of avian influenza in the U.S. Most interesting was a finding supporting the idea that the virus can be transmitted through air. Researchers found that the virus was spread up to a half mile during two windy days that appear to be related to clusters of outbreaks 5 to 7 days later. An airborne virus means companies would have to change some procedures in their large barns that can house tens of thousands of birds. For instance, the companies might need to change their ventilation systems, placing filters or blocks on the large vents and fans on the poultry barns. And although Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack had speculated earlier that the virus might have been spread by humans, USDA veterinarians hadn't yet pointed to possible spreading by, for instance, workers on the farms or those driving trucks between the infected areas. The study confirmed that biosecurity measures were broken. The current outbreak and rapid spread by environmental factors has changed the mantra of biosecurity. Instead of trying to prevent the disease from coming on a property, now producers must be concerned about the pathogen moving from barn to barn on each farm. The largest outbreak of bird flu in the U.S. has ravaged the egg and turkey industries in the upper Midwest, resulting in the killing of nearly 47 million birds. The virus has not spread to humans, and scientists say that risk is very low. Check out the full stories on our website, eartheats.org. And don't be a stranger on Twitter. Join the conversation at Earth Eats.
Fantastic work. Thanks, Luann.
My pleasure.
In the U.S., 1 in 6 people struggles with hunger. Food pantries across the country pass out food to help these people put meals on their tables. But what if you could help teach the pantry visitors how to grow their own food, too? Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted reports on one Midwest project that is doing just that.
It's a wet spring morning in Columbia, Missouri. A blue pop-up tent stands in the parking lot outside Central Pantry. Under the tent, 4 volunteers, including Marie Paisley, are repotting about 50 starter tomato plants into larger containers.
Then you press it in. We're giving them a trowel and some literature on how to grow, and that's it.
She's volunteering for Grow Well Missouri, a program that travels to food pantries around central Missouri and passes out seeds and starter plants to low-income locals. Today, they have a steady stream of visitors stopping by, curious about what's going on.
You want a tomato?
Yes.
Customers who pick up a tomato kit are given instructions on how to successfully take care of their new plant.
When you get it home, you need to water it through thoroughly till the water runs out the bottom of the container.
Uh-huh.
And then that'll be a good amount of water for several days. If you set it out in the rain, it'll probably get plenty of water. And it's fine to set outside.
Okay, thank you.
Bill McKelvey created Grow Well Missouri, now in its second year, in part to provide better access to healthful food.
It's really probably the highest quality food that you can get, right? You've grown it yourself, you pick it, and you eat it.
You know, a lot of what obviously is donated because it keeps longer is stuff that's canned and all of these kinds of things.
Livia Marquez is a food and health program officer with the W.K. Kellogg Foundation. She says fresh produce is really hard to come by, especially for people who rely on food banks.
So having that access to the fresh produce through different means, I think, is really critical.
But Bill McKelvey says the program also tries to deliver more than just nutritious food.
I think gardening provides people with a sense of satisfaction and a sense of self-sufficiency. And really, that's regardless of your income.
Out of the 158 program participants surveyed last year, nearly 90% actually planted gardens. And more than 90% of the gardeners say they shared their produce with friends and family. McKelvey says connecting people to their food also helps connect them to each other, like Carissa Colony. As it sprinkles in the parking lot, Colony quickly pushes her shopping cart back to her car. She snagged a tomato plant today.
This is the first time I've done this.
She says she's been gardening for 5 years, but this is her first Grow Well plant.
So why pick up a tomato?
My son and I like tomatoes, and we like to grow them.
McKelvey says more than half of the people who pick up plants or seeds have some form of gardening experience. Many of those gardeners start with seeds, which can be picked up inside the pantry. Just past the bread shelf and halfway to the cooler sits a table with 2 volunteers.
Oh, hi, good morning. My name's Deborah Blakely.
And I'm Kate Markey, and right now we're in getting towards the end of our giving away seed season.
There are hundreds of seed packets on the table, along with instructions and tips on how to grow them. Here, pantry shoppers pick up seeds from Blakely and Markey for everything from carrots and spinach to cantaloupe and watermelon, and...
You know, when I did this a few weeks ago, we offered flower seeds, and I saw their faces light up because they had been by already to pick up their vegetable seeds, but then they said, oh, today you have flower seeds. So, yeah, they stopped by again.
Project coordinator Bill McKelvey says that ultimately the goal is to have people returning and trying new fruits and vegetables every year. That can help food pantries develop a more sustainable relationship with their clients and can help clients continue to access fresh food and the health benefits that come with it.
A lot of the work we're doing now is really going to help us kind of build a model for how other groups can do this project.
He says at the end of the year, Grow Well will host workshops and training sessions for other Midwest groups interested in initiating their own version of the project. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
Get on their website for more stories like this one, harvestpublicmedia.org. Consumers want access to organic foods, and grocery stores know it. According to a USDA report from last year, nearly 3 of 4 conventional grocery stores now offer organic products. That's in addition to the 20,000 natural stores across the country. Increased access seems like a good thing for consumers, but some co-op groceries are getting lost in the shuffle. I got C.E. Pugh on the phone to talk about how co-ops are faring with all this competition.
I'm the Chief Operating Officer for National Co-op Grocers. We are the purchasing co-op for 143 food co-ops in the United States.
To get some perspective on where we are now, Pugh says we need to know where we've come from. Growth in co-ops went hand-in-hand with consumers' increased interest in organic and natural products.
For 20 or 30 years, the food co-ops in the United States enjoyed sustained double-digit year-over-year growth. That has declined in the past, particularly the past 4 or 5 years, to single-digit growth, most recently below 5%.
That's when conventional stores started getting into the organic game. Lately, the status of co-op groceries has been all over the map.
But within the 195 stores today, we see about 25% of this group strong double-digit growth. And those are folks that have continued to invest. They've expanded. They've remodeled. They've opened additional locations. About 10% of the group is experiencing double-digit sales declines. And those are, for the most part, the result of a new direct competitor opening in their market.
Like Lucky's Market, Fresh Time, Earth Fair, Fresh Market. Those are the new guard of natural food suppliers. That's along with established chains like Whole Foods and Trader Joe's expanding into new areas. That's an explanation for financial struggles of individual co-ops around the country. As for the slowing growth of co-ops overall...
Because we have slowing growth in markets where there's not a new competitor. So we'll go a little deeper. And where that's coming from is the growth in natural and organic by the conventional operators.
Think Walmart, Kroger, Costco, Publix, Safeway.
The only portion of retail food that's growing is natural and organic. The conventional space has been flat for years. And last year... natural and organic retail got to the point where it's 15% of all retail food. It surpassed $100 billion. So now there's enough scale to where it becomes very attractive to these larger companies.
And, he says, for the first time, these conventional stores are taking a bigger slice of the natural and organic food sales in the country. 42% for the Walmarts and the Krogers versus 40% for the Whole Foods and the co-ops. Pugh says conventional stores are having an easier time than co-ops when they want to expand or add new products to their shelves. Think about it like this.
In the natural space, you've got to open new stores. You've got to expand retail space. The conventional guys, they've already got thousands of stores all over the country. All they have to do is add product, and boom, they generate tremendous growth.
Tremendous is the word for how organic sales have skyrocketed. From $3.6 billion in 1997 to $39 billion-plus in 2014. And projections say growth will likely increase another 14% through 2018. Pugh says he's seen the trends develop over the years, and he knew this competition was on its way. Co-ops had enjoyed years and years of being the only game in town for consumers who wanted to eat in a more thoughtful way.
If we wanted to do that, we had to go find a natural and organic retail store because there was very little to none available in the conventional space. So we left the conventional retailers, headed over to the natural and organic store that we could find, and that's what generated that growth for many years. Today, if we want to make that decision, we want to begin to make different choices in the groceries we buy. We don't have to leave Kroger. It's already there.
Coming up, more with C.E. Pugh. He'll talk about what made co-op groceries successful back in the 70s and what they need to do today to stay relevant. Then we move into the cooking portion of our show.
You could take it and ferment it, which is what a lot of root beer, that's how a lot of root beer is made, similar to actually making beer. What we do is make a syrup and then combine that with club soda.
We'll hear Jackie Howard's root beer recipe and meet the farmer from whom she buys that one necessary ingredient. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations, bloomingfoods.coop. Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats. Annie Corrigan here.
One of the great things about having a garden is to go out every morning and see what's happened out there. And you always find your squash blossoms.
Daniel Orr, not just a chef, but also an avid gardener. This recipe, he says, tastes like summer in Italy. Here it is.
The ones that we're taking are mostly the male blossoms, because you're not going to get any zucchini from them, so you might as well go ahead and just grab those off every morning. And when you get enough of them, you can do a recipe like we're going to do today. What we do is we just kind of open them up, and it's almost like they almost feel silky, and it's almost like opening up a piece of cloth. All right, next I'm going to marinate the mozzarella. I've got some nice fresh mozzarella. With a little bit of salt and pepper, and then a little bit of olive oil. We're going to wrap these in a basil leaf and then stuff them into the squash blossom. Okay, the other thing that I like to do, and what my friend in Italy showed me to do, is to also add a little anchovy to this. So now I'm just going to roll these up, okay, and then press them together. So you've made these little tight little packages. Okay, now that we have our packages made up, just going to crack a couple eggs. And this is what in the business we call standard breading procedure. All right, so you have your flour, your egg mixture, and then your breadcrumbs. And then one thing that people always do is they always get their hands all gunky when they're doing this kind of thing. So what you want to do is have a dry hand and a wet hand. All right, so with your dry hand, you're going to do your flour, and then you put it into the egg. So you really want to make sure that they're totally encased in the egg mixture. Okay, then the final process in the standard breading procedure is the breadcrumbs. We're using panko. Okay, once they're all nicely coated, we're going to go over to the stove and just simply sauté them up. We have probably about an eighth to a quarter of an inch of oil in here. And we're just going to gently put them down inside. Fry these till they're nice and golden on all sides. We want to cook them long enough that the mozzarella has time to get warm and melt, because that's what it's all about, is that nice gooey mozzarella on the inside and the nice crunchy breading on the outside. And you'll know when they're just about done, when you might see a little bit of the mozzarella seeping out of the squash blossom packages. The French would call it bavouze, which means drooling. And that's how they like their omelets. So you want to do the same thing with these zucchini flowers, is just have them kind of drooling at you.
The sound of bubbling frying oil. Give them a fry for 90 seconds or so on each side. You could steam these instead if you'd rather. Follow along with the recipe at eartheats.org. C.E. Pugh works with the National Co-op Grocers out of Iowa City, Iowa. In the first half of the show, he laid out the numbers to show why co-ops are having a tough time competing in the new world of natural and organic grocery stores. Decades ago, co-ops enjoyed almost complete ownership of the natural and organic market. Pugh says the concept grew out of buying clubs, like the one he and his wife joined in Tennessee in the 80s.
We had no natural organic food store at all. We joined a few other families,
place an order to a wholesaler in Ohio. That tractor and trailer would show up at a church parking lot in our community one day a month, and we'd all head over there, unload the truck, split the stuff up, and that's the best we could do at that time. And this was true for many, many communities back in the 60s and 70s. There were no national organic retail food stores.
Eventually, demand outgrew that system, so he says opening a brick-and-mortar co-op grocery was a natural next step for people. It gave everyone more convenient access to natural and organic food.
You had demand, didn't have a retail space, so folks came together, pooled their money, started a co-op to open a small store.
Some of these first co-op groceries are celebrating their 40th anniversaries. Pew says one of the challenges they're facing now, after years of growth and success, is keeping members involved and engaged.
When these things started, there's couple hundred families who were very engaged and knew each other and very close to it. You move 30, 40 years later, there are tens of thousands of co-op owners don't have the same connection to the business that the founders did. It's perfectly understandable.
That's one of the in-house difficulties co-ops are dealing with. For 20 to 30 years, he says another challenge had been keeping up with demand. How do co-ops grow in the right way to meet customers' needs?
How to find another parking space, how to get another shopping cart, how to get another shelf in the store. It was that type of challenge. Now the challenges have shifted to a more focus on efficiency and productivity and more pure, what most people might think of as more purely business 101.
The number of new competitors flooding the market in the past several years didn't surprise him. He saw this coming.
I do. If there is an aspect of surprise, it is the degree of the impact. We knew there would be an impact. I don't think folks thought it would be quite as severe in some cases as it has been. Now, also, but let me say, there are many co-ops doing great. There are many markets that began to get much more competitive back in the 80s as Whole Foods and Wild Oats, and at least for the food co-ops, who suffered a decline then, sort of tightened up their businesses, changed their approach, got more competitive, got more aggressive. They're doing great today.
And that's the mentality more and more food co-ops are going to need to embrace as competitors continue to snatch up more and more of the natural organic dollar. I asked him if he's ever met with a struggling co-op and concluded that the only solution was to close up shop.
No. But, well, I couldn't say. Most of the time, the solutions are painful. And, you know, that ends up, okay, we've got a path here to success, but it's going to hurt.
Pew can also put a positive spin on all this.
We think to some extent, we're a victim of our own success. We wanted folks to start making better choices. We believe that every acre of farmland that switches from conventional to organic is great for the planet. It's what we all wanted. And now it's happening, and there's more choice and more access, and co-ops are going to be fine. They're just going to have to adjust to the new, a little more competitive marketplace. You know, Kroger just made it a lot easier to buy this product. So we have to take a look at our situation and say, all right, what can we do to remove potential barriers?
Because he believes people do want to shop at their local food co-op. Chief Operating Officer for National Co-op Grocers, C.E. Pew. Listen to this interview again at eartheats.org. John Allen Flynn's table at the Bloomington Community Farmers Market is divided in two parts.
Basically, this side of the table is foraging. Yeah, this is gardening, and this is my wood stuff, right.
The result is a really diverse offering this morning. Blackberries, broccoli, zucchini, peppers, walnuts, and sassafras.
I have numerous sassafras trees on my property, and I just sell it to people. They make tea out of it, and some people try to make root beer out of it.
Jackie Howard came across Flynn's table one Saturday morning. She shops at the farmer's market all the time for local fruit to incorporate into her soda recipes. She's a co-owner of Bee's Soda Bar. Sassafras bark is usually hard to find, she says, so she knew she found something special with Flynn. She immediately started playing with root beer recipes to see what could work for her food truck.
You could take it and ferment it, which is what a lot of root beer That's how a lot of root beer is made, similar to actually making beer. What we do is make a syrup and then combine that with club soda.
That way, it's easier for them to transport because they wouldn't have to bottle or keg it. And they could also use the syrup in other preparations. Root beer shot in your coffee? Why not? She started with your basic root beer recipe of wintergreen, sarsaparilla, sassafras, and anise. That was the base. Then it was time to experiment. One batch had hops. That got mixed reviews. Lavender and coffee grounds made appearances. After lots of tinkering, the final list includes the basics plus burdock root, wild cherry bark, cinnamon sticks, and vanilla beans.
And we always do throw just a splash of lemon juice into it, just to add some acidity, again, to kind of like give that little pop that you want from a soda. You really, when you think about it, you're essentially making a sweet tea. You know, like that's what making this syrup comes out to, because it's all these different roots and leaves, and you know, like, that's what it is. So you're making a tea.
And as with many teas, this recipe is pretty light, both in flavor and color. Jackie wanted her root beer to be bold.
So to add that depth without adding caramel color and things like that that you get in a bottled root beer, that's where we add the molasses. We use brown sugar to add some depth.
Along with turbinado and cane sugar, she lets the mixture steep just like a tea and then reduces it down by a third, and we're ready to try it.
So then you're going to put it into the glass. You want to pour it over ice. Soda needs to be really cold for it to be as fizzy as possible.
The anise smell in that is overwhelming.
Right. It definitely it is very anisey, and it's interesting. It's very little anise in comparison to everything else that you're putting into it. This, I think, after you taste it, it won't seem as anisey to you. We like the club soda for that carbonic bite. Give it a good stir, folding that syrup up into your soda so you don't lose the fizz from the soda.
Okay, I'm going to give it a taste.
All right.
Ooh, I like that a lot. I'm trying to figure out what that... There's something unique in there that I don't get from typical bottled root beer. What is that?
Probably the sassafras, honestly. When you get any sort of bottled root beer that you would buy at the store, it does not have sassafras.
I'm just going to keep drinking this. It's so delicious. Make Bee's Soda Bar's signature root beer recipe for yourself. I know I want to try it. The recipe is at eartheats.org. So, what does John Allen Flynn think about the root beer made from his sassafras?
I don't know. He has not tasted our root beer. He knows that we make root beer, but he's just happy to bring us bundles and bundles. All right, I'll bring you more next week. I'll bring you more next week. So that's, he's really great.
All right, Jackie Howard, thanks for the drink. Also, thanks to our everyday team here at Earth Eats, Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepherd, and all the folks at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations. Bloomingfoods.coop. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Last episode before the first day of summer. How about that? Enjoy yourselves. I'm Annie Corrigan.